Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Host Tucker Perkins recorded this special episode from Reuters Energy Transition North America in Houston, where he talked to business leaders and other experts at the forefront of driving climate innovation. Now, here's Tucker.
In this episode of Path to Zero from the Reuters Energy Transition Summit in Houston, we get to visit with an expert in decarbonizing power companies. Robert Yeager is president of the Power and Water Solutions at Emerson.
Bob, thank you for being with us today at Reuters, and just so glad to have you on Path to Zero.
Well, thanks, Tucker. I really appreciate it. It's very kind of you to have me.
You're coming off of a talk to the group on the main stage.
I am.
And if I get my notes right, your talk was Bearing the Load, the Price of Decarbonization.
That's right.
Tell me about what you said.
Well, I led off by talking about just the drivers for global decarbonization. And there's a lot of them. There's basically two categories. There's kind of a social, environmental, and then regulatory. And the social aspect of things is just this passionate feelings towards global warming, air quality, health issues. So there's just the whole world seems to be saying, you know, we need to do something about it. And who doesn't want clean air? So you have this, you know, big pressure from all over the world to reduce carbon footprint. But then it's also regulatory driven. So, you know, the United States EPA in the U.S. In May, you might have heard of EPA Rule 2023. And it says that on top of everything else that we're doing, we want the coal and gas plants to reduce carbon emissions by 600 megatons by 2042. So that puts an enormous pressure on our prime movers in the U.S. from a regulatory perspective. And in China, I just got back from China. We have 1,000 systems in China. They have a 14th five-year plan, and they have very well-defined goals for decarbonization. Although they emit a lot of CO2, 11 million kilotons, they are working to try to make it better.
So are those the two main drivers?
Well, there's the social, economic, and then regulatory. I'd say those are the two main drivers. And it varies by region, varies by, you know, from a regulatory perspective, by country, basically. But everyone has their regulations.
Right. As you look across maybe the country, but lovely if you could just talk about the U.S. or North America.
Sure.
Do you see some examples, some really shining success stories as we move to decarbonization?
Well, it's challenging. There's certainly been a lot of renewables being added. You know, many, many megawatts of solar and wind. So I would say that's a success story. We're sitting here in Texas, and there's been an enormous amount of generation added from solar and wind.
What's the role of Emerson in this transformation? Tell me, what are you doing to affect this transformation?
So what we do, my business unit is we automate power plants. We automate 1.4 million megawatts around the world. We have, in the United States, we have 500,000 megawatts nameplate generated capacity. That's about half the U.S. capacity. We have thousands and thousands of gas and steam turbines that we automate. We have 65,000 wind turbines, 3,500 hydro generating units, 1,000 systems in China, and 100 operating nuclear units. So we provide the control systems that basically, from a generation perspective, allow you to visualize the process, look at it in real time, troubleshoot it and debug it. And we do that all around the world for all fuel types.
And that's around mainly efficiency?
It's around coordinated control. So in the large prime movers like coal and combined cycle, we run in something called full auto. And I like to say that every day around the world, we do $1 million saves. So if you have a large 1,000 megawatt coal unit or a 800 megawatt combined cycle, and there's a pump or a fan or a motor that might fail, we do a very graceful run back from full load. Maybe it's 1,000 megawatts to 800 megawatts, and we save the unit from tripping offline. That's one of the main things we do. Now, we do have advanced process control software that allows us to reduce heat rate. We have automated test procedures to make the whole process more efficient. But primarily, it's providing very reliable control strategies for all of the prime movers that we do. And prime movers, I mean systems with a lot of inertia.
You know, as you think about kind of the grid as it needs to become in the future, one of the points of what I would call the dreamers is that we've got to get rid of this decentralized system, these balancing authorities, and go to a national grid. Certainly would make your job a lot easier if we had one national grid. You talked earlier about social concerns, regulatory barriers. What's the likelihood that we would ever get to a national grid?
Well, you're talking about sort of the U.S. government, you know, FERC and NERC and the balancing authorities, the ISOs and the RTOs. So there's a lot of maybe politics involved. No doubt if you could create a national grid and not have ERCOT, PGM, MISO, and so on, Cal ISO, you could probably argue that it would improve electricity generation security. Well, there's still one big issue, I think, that's bigger than just connecting all of the segments together, and that is the perceived or real lack of inertia in the system. As more and more renewables are being added and the prime movers, the coal and gas plants, are being shut down, it is creating grid stability. Grid's very sensitive to frequency, right? At 60 hertz in the U.S., 50 hertz outside the U.S., you know, at 59, at two-tenths of a hertz, bad things start to happen if you get a dip of two-tenths on the frequency. You have, you get trip circuits that kick off, you know, in industrial units. You get equipment failures, or equipment can happen, and if it drops down to 6 to 7 to 8 tenths, you can get a total grid collapse. So what you really need is these big pieces of spinning metal, right, turbines, that create this dampening effect on the grid. If you need more power to maintain frequency, you just put in more, open some valves, and you got it. You can't do that with wind and solar. You can't say, please let the sun shine more, please let the wind be stronger.
How long do you think it will be before long-duration energy storage is maybe a real part of our grid?
Well, I think energy storage, two things come to mind. One is hydrogen. Everyone's talking about hydrogen, and we're working on a large project now at Intermountain Power where there were coal units there, and they're installing electrolyzers that will generate green hydrogen. It'll be stored in the salt domes there. And that will drive an 840 megawatt combined cycle. Great example of energy storage, great example of renewable, driving hydrogen and using renewable energy to drive that. But the issue with hydrogen is a lot of the gas turbines in the combined cycles don't run fully on hydrogen yet. They will. And it's kind of at least restricted right now to places where you can store hydrogen, like on the salt dome in Utah. The issue is transporting hydrogen. I think that's what people struggle with, because it's obviously, very explosive, it could be dangerous, and I think that's probably an issue with that. Battery storage is good. We're working on some of the largest battery projects in the world. Vistra Energy at Moss Landing in Northern California is one. That's 3,000 megawatt hours of battery generation, right, that can help with frequency response. But that's only for a few hours, right? So it's not like a large steam turbine that runs 24/7.
So you don't really, there's no solution. I mean, that's a great niche solution. But as you say, you need to have the geology to store hydrogen. So you don't see on the short-term horizon any great battery storage.
On the short-term horizon, to have a fully dispatchable 24/7 prime moving technology that's renewable It's not in the near term.
And, you know, I'm glad you're here, because one of the things that's been in the news this week a little bit is, again, about using technology that would drive down the growth in the grid. So technology would be able to balance loads. You're in the kind of the middle of using technology, I think. Do you see how there's a technology out there that would actually dampen overall demand? I've never understood in my own mind how.
Well, there are. So there's two ways to manage load and maintain frequency, add more active and reactive power to the system by having these prime movers or large gas and steam turbines add more power in, right? And dispatchable. The other way is demand side management, where you just reduce the load. So there are many utilities that have and are working on demand side management. So they'll have intelligent meters, right, that and home systems that will allow them to interface to tens or hundreds or thousands of homes on their distribution side and actually dial back energy consumption when they need to.
And that's as simple as, some of them are easy, don't charge my car right now, don't turn my refrigerator on, let my cooling go up a couple degrees. Is it those good examples?
Those are really good examples. And if the utility can control that, or actually the ISO or the RTO, that helps a lot to manage in times where there is a
it becomes a significant demand response.
It can be.
Interesting.
It can be.
Hey, let's give you it may not be your world, but Emerson's not only a leader in power, Emerson's a leader in water. Do you work at all as we think about kind of the water demands of the future? Are you involved in that at all?
We are. So I mentioned all of the power plants that we automate around the world, the 1.4 million megawatts. We also treat 12 billion gallons per day of water in the U.S.
Oh.
So we have Washington, D.C., New York City, Miami, Detroit, Chicago.
Those are industrial uses
of water? San Francisco. The municipal water
treatment.
The municipal water system.
Yeah.
For example, City of Chicago treats 1.3 billion gallons per day. We automate that whole, most of the whole process. Detroit's about the same. New York City. So we're extremely involved in the water treatment side, and provide all that automation in addition to the power plants in the U.S.
So there's a lot of work going on. I mean, I find water is probably something we haven't talked about enough, and we're just starting to talk about it as we realize water is a resource just like energy.
Oh, it absolutely is. Water, you know, not only for clean water that's needed in the water treatment, but for power generation.
Emerson's been a leader in wind as well, and maybe, I know you probably worked a lot of this, but as we think about wind, do we have a problem with aging existing wind turbines?
Yes. So we automate 65,000 wind turbines around the world. And many of them are subject to vibration, right, and failure.
That's the main enemy.
It's one of the main enemies. Yeah. So we do the controls. We do the pitch and the yaw, and also can extract data out of the wind turbines to monitor very carefully the stresses on it and if they're about to fail mechanically. But we can do things like dynamic derate and wind farm optimization. So if the wind picks up, it's very strong at a certain point, and the utility does not need the megawatts, we can dynamically run back the wind turbines to save them from excess wear and tear. So, you know, that's an enormous cost savings. It's very expensive to repair, especially offshore. Right? You can get the picture of how expensive that is to repair.
Wow, fascinating.
Especially if they're out of warranty.
Hey, we have a little fun on this podcast. We use a little magic. And one of the things we love to do is hand you a magic wand. And you get to use that wand for one thing in the next year that you think would have the biggest impact on the energy transformation. How would you use your wand?
Well, Tiger, yeah, we already talked about it. For me, that's easy. It would be to have what we talked about, a renewable source of power generation that's fully dispatchable. You know, if that technology was available, a lot of the discussion we see about global warming and CO2 emissions would just go away because you could just use that and wind down the coal and gas generation.
And nothing like that really exists today at scale, I guess.
No. No. Like I said, hydrogen is going in the right direction. Battery, but batteries don't have inertia. They have inertia-like characteristics right. where they can inject active and reactive power into the system very quickly, but they can only run for a few, you know, 4 or 5 hours.
Where do you think nuclear falls out in our energy transformation?
Right.
You think
so
it grows?
It does. So I mentioned we automate 100 operating nuclear plants around the world. They're pretty much base loaded. You know, if you look at the dispatch stack in any market, the first units that come onto the dispatch stack are the nukes. They're base loaded. They run because of the operating cost is low once they're built. CapEx intensive, but OpEx not so much. There's a lot of discussion now on small modular reactors. There are a number of manufacturers of the large, like Westinghouse, GE, and so on, that are building smaller versions of the 1,000 megawatt or 1,200 megawatt units. Westinghouse has the AP1000 is a pressurized water reactor. Mm-hmm. They're building a 300 megawatt version of that, which it remains to be seen, do the economics work? You know, do the economics get cut by a third from a 1,000 megawatt construction and capital investment to a third of that for a 300 megawatt? If they don't, it doesn't make a lot of sense to build it. And you still have the NRC. You
right.
still have to get licensing and so on and so forth. So,
do you think the economics get there?
I think it remains to be seen.
It's funny.
Yeah.
Smart people, I find, have strong opinions, yes and no. It's a very divisive issue. All around cost.
Yeah. I think that you know, the first SMRs that are built, we'll find out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because there's been a long history, as you know, in this country, of just cost overruns building nuclear, and for good reason. You know, it can be extremely dangerous if it's not done correctly.
Yeah.
So,
I want to thank you for stopping by. It's been great to have you, and thanks for coming to Houston and speaking to this crowd at the Reuters conference.
Thanks, thank you, Tucker. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to a special edition of Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to path2zero@propane.com.